All right. I guess my role in the program is to talk about data. I'm sorry that if you're hoping for cutting-edge new results, that's not what you're going to see. So the best I'll be able to do is try to pull into perspective the role these particular types of neutrinos, I mean atmospheric and accelerator neutrinos that are aimed at the same region, play in the role of the physics for this conference. And clearly the main role it plays is a great motivation. So the first part of my talk, I'll just quickly recap what the evidence is for neutrino oscillation from atmospheric neutrinos. And then I'll go into a little bit of the detailed studies that we have been able to make thanks to having such an enormous data sample from Super Kamiokande, 10,000 atmospheric neutrinos in total. And then finally, tie it together with the first new experiment that is attempting to see the same physics results, the same neutrino oscillation, but by a completely different method. So it's confirmation, but I hope you'll treat it as much more than just some sort of narrowing of parameter space. If what we had in our minds as underlying the phenomena we see in atmospheric neutrinos didn't fit into the quantum mechanical description of neutrino oscillation, to change the picture around completely experimentally is the place you might hope to see a difference. In the end, it's not likely to do that, but that's really the goal. It's not just to make a somewhat better measurement of delta M squared. It's really to test it with completely different systematics. So I've said systematics already, so this is going to be a very experimental lecture. So feel free to interrupt me and ask questions, and other than that, you'll see a fairly standard set of results. So the detector, which has really opened up the study of neutrinos with mass squared differences around 10 to the minus 3 eV squared, is Super Kamiokande. Evidence was seen years ago in IMB and Kamiokande, but only when we had an extremely large data set did the picture really become clear. So this is what our detector looks like. It's enormous, 22.5 kilotons of ultra-pure water. And in the first phase of the detector, it was viewed by 11,000 photomultiplier tubes with about a 40% photocathode coverage. So 20 times larger than previous detectors, twice as much photocathode coverage. You know, really a next generation experiment, like moving from the Tevatron to the LHC. As you're probably aware, we had an unfortunate accident in November of 2001 where approximately half the photomultiplier tubes were lost due to a chain reaction. And so we've recovered from that. We have a new design for enclosing the photomultiplier tubes. This is what it looks like. It's a fiberglass shield behind and a transparent acrylic shield in front over the photocathode, with little bits of holes in it, so that if this tube were to implode, and you know, with 10,000 phototubes, you have to allow for that, the dynamics would change and you wouldn't form the shockwave chain reaction. So the status of the detector is this is now in place. Because we lost so many phototubes, we were only able to populate the surface with half of the original coverage, and they all look like this now, but we are running. And then the plan, and I believe this has recently been approved or will soon be approved in Japan, is to buy the remainder of the phototubes to bring us back to the original photocathode coverage, and that should be ready to go in sometime around 2006. So you could call these Super K1, Super K2, and Super K3. Well, I don't think they've caught on yet, but that's how we refer to them internally. All right, so the evidence for neutrino oscillation is truly beautiful, and everyone should really appreciate it. It relies on a couple normalizing factors that neutrinos formed in cosmic rays should, at relatively low energies, have a ratio of about 2 to 1 muon neutrino to electron neutrino. And in any case, it's very well predicted because you can cancel out uncertainties due to the well-understood chain of meson decay. And then at high energies, you can exploit the fact that neutrinos that travel from below and that travel from above should arise from the same original flux. So at low energies, what we tend to do, just to show people that there is this effect, is take the ratio of the muon neutrinos to electron neutrinos that we count in the data, and then we have a detailed Monte Carlo of of our detector where we can incorporate all physics effects, and we find that it's very significantly different from zero. Now that's just a number, and there are graphs that go with it, but probably the single most visible evidence of neutrino oscillation is to look at the higher energy neutrinos, free from geomagnetic and other low energy effects, and you see a dramatic asymmetry in the number of neutrinos that are traveling up versus those that are traveling down. The statistical significance is more than 10 sigma, and you know, you can see it right here in this plot. The data points in black do not at all fit the prediction in blue, and that prediction is very robust as far as up-down symmetry goes. So that hits you over the head and tells you you have neutrino oscillations. To interpret it, you don't actually have to do much more. You would see in the previous picture that in the electron neutrinos, high energy electron neutrinos, you don't see any particular excess appearing where the deficit of muon neutrinos left us. So you can conclude, and there's a little bit more to it, that this is the only reasonable conclusion, that it's two flavor oscillation between muon neutrino and tau neutrino flavors, given by standard vacuum formula. The parameters are fairly easy to read off just based on the distances traveled and the fact that these are, say, 3 to 5 GeV neutrinos. And the fact that it's maximal mixing is fairly easy to read off because the data is falling at around half the height of the prediction, and that can be neatly explained by averaging over many wavelengths. And then if you were to, you know, rebin the data in certain ways, you would see that this formula with the critical term of L over E fairly well describes the data. What we want to do then is push on this a little bit, and I'll get to that shortly. All right, so that's the simplistic view of things. The way we really do almost all of our physics is to take the neutrino events in a variety of energy and zenith bins. So the zenith bins represent path length, the energy bins represent, you know, it's the energy of the lepton, but it somehow feeds back to the energy of the neutrino, and we can bin it in an enormous number of ways. The low energy electron and muon data, and then the high energy electron and muon data are here, and then we add a variety of other samples that gives us additional handles. For example, we can analyze multi-ring events where we find one muon present, and we see in those events, so these are multi-particle final states like this little cartoon, so we see in that data set similar evidence for neutrino oscillation. We can look at multi-ring events where a muon is not present, where it's typically all electromagnetic showers. This is dominated by, not exactly dominated, but has a large proportion of neutral current, and you see in that rather symmetric distribution of data. The height isn't quite right, but that's because we don't understand all the cross-section and fluxes perfectly. So when necessary, we don't allow the flux to be a constraint, and that's most of the time. And then we have this other category of events where the neutrino interacts somewhere around the detector, like below it, and a muon, so only charged current muon interactions are relevant now, and a muon might enter the detector and stop, and that tends to come from lower energy neutrinos, or it might enter the detector and keep right on going, and that comes from high energy neutrinos. So lower energy neutrinos show less of an effect, and high energy show more of an oscillation effect, and high energy neutrinos show less. And so we fit all of this data together, and we have a, you know, elaborate mechanism for it, but we feel it's quite robust. And we find detailed numbers for our parameter estimates based on the last set of analyses and the last set of data. Best fit is delta M squared of around 2.5 times 10 to minus 3 eV squared, and the best fit in mixing angles quite strongly found to be near 1. So that's one experiment. It's always important to try to look at them with other experiments. I'm just going to quickly give you a snapshot of who else has shown that this effect is true. One of them is the macro experiment in Gran Sasso. And as it was built to detect magnetic monopoles, a very specialized detector, it cannot really study the contained neutrino interactions in as much detail, and particularly doesn't do electrons at all. But it's quite a large area detector and has nearly as many upward-going muons as super K. So this is an upward-going muon distribution, which is directly comparable to the last one shown for super K. And then through a little bit of perseverance, you can get low-energy samples where Here, a neutrino interacted in the middle of the absorber, which is the bottom of the detector, and it passed through two timing planes, so you can tell that it's upward going. Or there's another sample where it interacts in that absorber, and it's either upward going and it stops there, or it's downward going, and you can't tell them apart. But they have about the same energy, so you can still treat them statistically. So that's in good agreement. Another experiment which sort of cleared up one of the historical bones in your throat about the evidence for atmospheric neutrino oscillation is the Sudan experiment. That's because it's an iron target, not a water target. There was some time in the mid-90s when all the positive signatures were from water experiments and none were from other smaller iron experiments. But finally, a large iron experiment saw the effect. It can see both electrons and muons, so it can duplicate the double ratio measurement. And then one of the nice things that is possible with this sort of detector is you can identify things that are not visible in water Cherenkov detectors, namely, if you have a quasi-elastic scatter and there's the recoil proton. Well, for one thing, this gives you a very good estimate of the neutrino energy, because you have assuming it really is two-body, you have a two-body final state. And then for higher energy muons, you already have a good direction. So they have an analysis where they form basically the L over E variable. They make a high resolution sample, including events like this. And then this is the distribution of their data. This big dip in the middle is just a geometrical factor. It's present in everyone's atmospheric neutrino data. The other thing I'm going to note is that if you were to compare this with the result from Super Kamiokande, which went by a few slides ago, from above, which is this section of the two peaks, it seemed like the data in the Monte Carlo were right around one. They agreed perfectly. Here it seems there's a little bit of there's a deficit from above as well as from below. So this will imply, when you do the full analysis, that there's a little bit of difference in what they would estimate for the best fit value and what we would estimate. Well, all the rest will come down to errors. So here's comparing the results from these three different experiments. Of course, Super K with high statistics draws a very small allowed region. These are all 90% contours. And the macro upward going muon data, because it was just the same in shape as the Super K, has to naturally agree. And then here you can see Sudan 2 favors somewhat higher values, as you could infer from that distribution. And in fact, they're best fit points up there, but you shouldn't take best fit points as seriously as the general areas. So that's the setup for atmospheric neutrinos. It's good evidence for Nu-mu-nu-tau oscillation. And then what we've been concentrating on, in Super K anyway, for the past few years, is trying to squeeze more and more information out of the data. We've been constantly challenged by our theoretical colleagues to comment on other scenarios which could explain that data. And thanks to our large sample and our ability to associate them with lepton flavors, we've done a pretty good job. So the simplest way to explain how we do that is to consider that set of plots where all of the Super Kamiokande data was plotted versus versus theory. And then you can make a plot of the difference between the data points and then the best fit for any given oscillation model you might care to put into the data. So you start with the standard atmospheric neutrino production models. You have the spectrum information, the flavor ratio, and then you put in the detector response in great detail, and then you can consider nu mu nu e oscillation, which I quickly argued was ruled out, but now you can see the extent to which it's ruled out. The way to read the table like this is to basically compare the chi-squared for the best fit that you can get pushing the theory around to fit the data to the overall best fit, which is to nu mu nu tau. So it's again a difference of around 10 sigma. It's extremely, extremely unlikely, and the chi-squared is rather poor for that.
What is the number of degrees of freedom?
Something, it was on an earlier slide, it's something in the 190. It's in the hundreds. Pardon?
With all the alternatives?
Well, that's exactly what this table lays out. So some are better than others. New E, it's, you know, really, really a terrible fit. I just want to point out that...
I mean, in terms of degrees of freedom...
Yes, that's right. Well, other than... Let me make sure there's not an extra parameter in any of these models, but yeah. Up to the number of parameters in the fit, that's right. Good. Yeah, you guys are very good with numbers, aren't you? when we make the estimate for the best measurement of the neutrino oscillation parameters, we don't include the neutral current bins, because we're just trying to estimate the charge current muon neutrino behavior, and so neutral current doesn't add any information to it. It was sort of a technical choice to make. You should be able to include it. You should be able to include any set of bins. They would add equally poorly to all the chi-squares, right? It shouldn't affect the chi-square difference. So the fact that it's slightly different is probably just some numerical, you know, just a little numerical effect.
You know, it's has a big consequence for some experiments, whether it's two or three.
Absolutely, but I already told you that you shouldn't pay attention to best fit points, because the minima can often be a little bit rocky, because we have limited Monte Carlo statistics, and even when we have 10,000 events, we have limited data statistics. And so a few events that move from bin to bin, for whatever reason, we change the water transparency, and that changes the particle identification a little, can bump things from one minimum to another minimum. So I am very sensitive to the fact that 2.1 is different than 2.5 for planning future experiments. But in terms of the allowed region, it's not that... You want to be conservative and not let small differences like that bother you when you plan those experiments. So it would seem, as I paused there just to try to make sure I understood what was the difference between this set of analyses and what we do for the regular. I'm quite sure we don't include neutral current in that analysis, but we do here. So I conclude that that's the source of the difference. Other than that, the data set is the same and the Monte Carlo is the same.
Mm-hmm.
Well, if you wanted me to check, I think it's a different number of degrees of freedom. So we had 172 before. So we've added bins in to try to do these separation of hypotheses. And, you know, when you add a little bit of data in Monte Carlo, things can fluctuate. Okay? Good. Okay, so... essentially, what you're doing is you're not checking goodness of fit, because some of these, if you were to just say, well, what is the chi-squared per degree of freedom compared to 1, seem like fairly reasonable percentages. But the proper way to evaluate rejecting hypotheses is to compare differences in chi-squareds. So you can see that some are quite strongly disfavored, like one variety of neutrino decay, but other ones are not so easy to exclude. But the worst situation we have is this model of neutrino decoherence, where the best fit that we can get to all of this data put together is it's around 3.2 sigma worse than our best fit to new mu nu tau, which is even then pretty significant. We're going to try to work on this, and we have some handles. And of course, no oscillations is just a terrible fit. There's not much you can do to the data other than play with the normalization. If you don't allow neutrino oscillations, there's no parameters you can fool around with, and it's a highly disfavored. Let me focus on the sterile neutrino hypothesis just a little bit and show you where the data disfavors it. I don't know how interested various people are in sterile neutrinos, but certainly when the effect first showed up, it was quite a viable alternative hypothesis. And adding in these other bins is what really helps us. you see that for higher energy neutrinos, there's generally speaking a suppression of the oscillation probability to a matter effect. This is just the difference in the forward scattering for new mu's, which have neutral current interaction in the Earth, and sterile neutrinos don't. Okay, so you do get a matter effect, and so it tends to show up in the highest energy bins. So for here is the multi-ring muon sample, and there's you would expect a suppression where we see, again in that previous plot, you saw the nice oscillation signature. So that's a very bad fit. The upward going muons should show no evidence of oscillation if this were true, and they do, so that's a bad fit. And then also the neutral current events, where are they? Well, I guess this isn't labeled as well as I would like, but a neutral current should disappear from below if it's new sterile oscillation. So those are the handles you can apply, and that's the roster of results. Yes, that's my next slide. So there's you have to pick a you have to pick a treatment for it, but there's a treatment proposed by the Bari group, where they consider a relative admixture between new mu nu tau oscillation and new mu nu sterile oscillation. And so we followed that and put this through our oscillation study framework. And we find that we limit the amount of new sterile component that could be possible in our data at 90% confidence level to something like less than 20 or 15%. This is somewhat better than they were able to do looking at our published bin data, because we have access to a more detailed Monte Carlo that includes all of the effects of, neutral current events are all mixed up with deep and elastic scattering and single pion production. And we have all of our bins and they don't. So it's a little bit, we can do a little bit better, and this is the best result. Okay. All right. And then beyond that, more exotic ideas. We've looked at CPT violation a little bit. This is not necessarily looking at it in the same way as motivated by LSND as a third evidence for neutrino oscillation, it's fairly easy to see how you would treat this in our data. Since we have Monte Carlo truth information, we can tell in our prediction on an event-by-event basis whether or not the event is coming from a neutrino or an antineutrino. So we can let there be a different delta M squared for antineutrinos than for neutrinos. Okay, so there's a little cartoon of what that would look like. And then refit the data allowing all these things to vary. Even though we don't have directly any direct sensitivity to antineutrinos versus neutrinos, it's buried in the data somehow due to the forward scattering and the cross section. It's in there. And so we don't see anything unusual. Our best fit point is somewhere here, very close to contours where this is the contour where the delta M squared is the same. Okay, so at some 90% confidence level, you can exclude a difference in delta M squareds of 0.003 or so. So that's one variety. Another variety proposed by Glashow and others is to consider a CP violating term in the oscillation formula. Basically, we can put anything you want into the oscillation formula, mangle it, and then see how large a coefficient is allowed. So in this particular idea, the coefficient is restricted to be less than 10 to the minus 9 in some funny units. But the point is, the best fit is essentially at the smallest value you could imagine. There's no evidence for any of this going on. There's no positive evidence. Maybe some scenarios are not ruled out as much as you might like, but there's nothing to give you any hope. So, if we can't find unusual aspects of neutrino oscillation, I guess we'll just have to look for the stuff that should be there. So, one of the things that should be there is a component of electron neutrino mixing. So, again, we take a fairly standard tact and consider a hierarchical model where the three-flavor oscillation formula is reduced to fairly simple form with only three parameters, theta 1, 3, theta 2, 3, and delta M squared. And so the strategy in terms of this analysis is to bin the data very finely, even finer than was shown in that previous plot. In the electron data, we make a number of very fine bins, because what we're hoping to see is some sort of hot spot of survival probability, okay, or disappearance probability. Take your pick. So this plot here shows the matter effect in the Earth on electron neutrinos. This is all for normal hierarchy. And you can see that it shows up at fairly high energies, which is good, because that means that the electron typically follows the direction of the neutrino, and that it's zenith angle dependent. Okay, so this is, if we really had access to neutrino energy, individually, this would be what we could hope to see. In fact, we have to at least work with the ratio of fluxes, and then it gets worse because it's smeared further by having to reconstruct it in a detector and measuring lepton energy instead.
Where does that occur about?
What do you expect under some circumstances?
This is what we expect if we were to take the parameters and put them right at the show limit. So pick delta m squared of 0.003, and then pick theta 2.3 to be 0.5, and theta 1.3 to be 0.024. So if we fool around with these numbers, the colors shift around in some interesting way. So this is just a template, okay?
Probably it's a simple explanation, but I don't understand why, in the case of oscillations, because it's nu which contributes, why the ratio is bigger than 1?
There's a larger new mu flux, which is feeding into the electron neutrino flux. And of course, this is the core of the Earth, right?
Actually, I mean, the red spot in the core is a kind of interference core mantle effect.
You mean these?
Yes.
Uh-huh. The fact that there's two of them, you mean? Okay. Well, it's evolution equation, so it's not hard to do numerically, and if you trust the matter density, you will get answers. So, unfortunately, again, we have no good news for you. You might hope that if the electron neutrino appearance probability was just around the corner of the show limit, which is plotted in yellow here, versus this mixing angle, which governs the probability of nu e appearance, that you might somehow see a positive signature and your allowed region would reject slightly the pure nu mu tau axis. But in fact, our best fit point is right here, is right on the nu mu nu tau axis. And there's, this is why there's a whole series of experiments to come that will attempt to look for this with much greater sensitivity than is possible. Okay. And so, so we have no control over what the mixing angle to electron neutrinos is, but there's one thing we know ought to be there, and that is charge current tau appearance. So what can we do in our data to find it? Well, taus are rather energetic. The threshold energy is 3.4 GeV, and when you boost to the lab frame, you have a nucleon with a fair amount of momentum. The tau is a fair amount of momentum. It's crashing out of oxygen typically. It's generally making a rather difficult to reconstruct event signature. But we have one great handle, which is for 3.4 GeV, you cannot have a significant oscillation appearance for downward going neutrinos. It can only happen for upward going. So what we do is an analysis where we try to find events like this, even though they're rather indistinguishable from other deep inelastic scatters, there should be more going up than down. So let me tell you how we do that. There's actually several different ways. We have about three groups of people playing around with different ideas. One uses a neural network, another uses likelihood, another uses some sort of energy flow type analysis. I'll describe the neural network a little bit, just as a template again. So this is the reaction you're looking for. Muon neutrino transforms into a tau neutrino, charge current interaction, energetic tau decays. Of course, the tau may decay to pions, one or three. And so that's more of the mess, and then there's the recoil hadronic system. So what we have done is taken all of the different things that we can see in our detector and try to categorize a difference between standard muon neutrino and electron neutrino interactions at this high energy and tau neutrino interactions. So the tau is a rather heavy particle. When it decays, this might be at relatively high PT. So you can look at the shape of things. This thing, a huff, is the way we do our ring findings. So this is essentially asking for the taus, which are in red, to have higher multiplicity. We don't really find 10 rings, but we find 10 seeds. Okay. We can count decay electrons. We can try to reject background by asking that the particle identification of the brightest ring not be muon-like, because that's sort of a dead giveaway, other than a few tau decays, that it's that the new mu charge current interaction. All these variables are put together, and through the magic of neural networks, they're weighted in a suitable fashion, and then we find an output which, depending on where you want to place your cut, says, gives you some sort of relative probability that the event has come from a tau interaction for an atmosphere or an atmosphere neutrino interaction. So we can tune and check this result a little bit. For example, in the downward going events, I've already argued, based on our best fit parameters. So this does presuppose that. You couldn't do this in a pure search. There can't be any tau neutrino events. So therefore, the neural network output should look very much like the non-tau or the muon neutrino signature, and it does. But then for the upward going events, again, we just apply some zenith angle cuts. If there's going to be any excess, you'd expect it to be shifted towards the direction of more tau-like event parameter, okay? So this isn't, this is a little bit intriguing because everything is a little bit high on this edge. Normalization in situations like this is very tricky. There's an awful lot of background, so this actually ought not to bother you too much because we don't rely on this data for any sort of tuning. If we get the amount of background wrong, it's not going to matter. What we really care about is, do we understand the data that's from here and from here, upward versus downward? Are we treating up and down symmetrically? And so then we look at our data, and we see data points which are rather symmetrical compared to a prediction which is somewhat asymmetrical. Okay, and the prediction is if you, through some sort of godforsaken model, subtracted tau charge current events and didn't, but you're not dealing with new sterile. Okay, it's not directly being compared against new sterile. It's just, what if those events were there? What if you tried to do the analysis and you just forgot about them? Okay, you get a fairly bad agreement between the data and the Monte Carlo in that case. However, if we add back in some number of tau events, then you can get a fairly good agreement. Okay, and the number of tau events you add back in is based on our fit to the rest of the data. Okay, so this is, again, not an independent method of observing neutrino oscillations. So, but the result is we can calculate how many we expected to put in. We think that 85 is the right number based on our neutrino oscillation parameters. And then we can do a fit to with and without tau appearance, and we get a number which is completely consistent with that. There's systematic uncertainties. This is just a statistical uncertainty. Plus or minus 13 means, well, we don't know exactly how many to put in. We have to consider the maximum and the minimum number of taus that could appear based on our contour. And then also we have to keep in mind that with some possible admixture of electron neutrino appearance, we could get more of these big showering upward going events. And so that gives a little bit of an asymmetric uncertainty due to that. Anyway, it's a consistent picture. We haven't really tried to use this as delta M squared is an input, so it's.
Right, but when you change your input,
it shifts it proportional to the oscillation probability. I mean, it goes directly in. It's a one-to-one correspondence. Okay, so the picture I painted from atmospheric neutrinos is there's no nothing to give you hope for new physics other than neutrino oscillations themselves. Everything seems to be panning out for new mu, new tau, and some of the things we would like to see, like new appearance, we can't see. So let's back up a little bit and see what we can do about an experiment to confirm with a completely different set of systematics that these are really neutrino oscillations. And that's clearly a long baseline experiment. This is where neutrino physics is, of course, headed now. The one I'll tell you about is the K2K experiment. So it's K-E-K to Kamioka. It goes about 250 kilometers at its deepest point, 1 kilometer under the ground in Japan. And since you can't run cables, we have to connect events from here to there by using simultaneous GPS timing. And by the way, there is no tunnel between here and there. Every time I show this to high school students or someone, they say, it's really a tunnel going between, you know, going across Japan? No, it's not a tunnel. You all know that. All right, so what we hope to see in this experiment is a clear, beautiful picture of neutrino oscillations. I think the atmospheric is very nice, this up-down asymmetry, but you don't really see the sine squared function yet. Okay, people are still looking. So this is what we could hope with a range of different values, which at some point in time are essentially compatible with the super Kamiokande results. If it was as large as 5 × 10⁻³ eV squared in an ideal experiment, this is the neutrino spectrum from KEK, you would see instead of this, a beautiful double humped signature. Of course, keep in mind that down here at 500 MeV to 1 GeV, it's tough experimentally. At 3 × 10⁻³ eV squared, you would see something like this, and then you run out of gas at around 1.5. So that's the goal.
So this is not a hydrogen detector.
No, this is just a, yeah. We fold everything together in the analysis, and it's incredibly complicated. All right, so instead of protons from cosmic rays, we have protons from accelerator. We have to bend them to select their momentum and aim them at super K. They hit a target, and then the pions decay in a 200-meter long decay pipe. And then right here is the, just over here is another neutrino hall with a set of near detectors for normalization. That's a very, very important part of this experiment. So the near detectors, there's a couple different types. There's a little water Cherenkov detector similar to Super K, but much smaller. It's 1 kiloton, so we call it the 1 kiloton detector. And it sees Cherenkov rings just like Super K. And it's and quite a large number of events because the flux is so large up close to the beam. And then we have a fine grain detector, which is composed of different components, some scintillating fiber tracker with water target planes, and then some steel slabs with drift tubes that stop the muons, and you see how far they go. So these are the sorts of events that you get. The water detector looks a bit like an event in Super K if it were very close to the wall. Everything's very close to the wall in a small detector. But we have hundreds of thousands of them. And this is a great resource for a lot of different physics, neutrino interaction physics, calculating the background for proton decay, but you know, moreover, calculating the spectrum for this experiment. And then we have this fine grain detector, which plays a great role because, like Sudan, you can see recoil protons, and that I'll describe what a valuable handle that is shortly. All right, so this is our running history. This is, you know, we've had a goal offered to us by the accelerator lab of 10 to the 20 protons on target, and as of the Super K accident, we had reached 0.56. Okay. Now, the great handle that we have in this experiment, and it's not quite like any other upcoming experiment is going to be, including MINOS, is that we are operating at low enough energy that we are dominated by quasi-elastic scatters. There's an annoying 30%-ish background of non-quasi-elastic, but when you have the two-body reaction, if you can measure the muon momentum or energy, doesn't matter, and direction, because you have a known beam direction due to surveying, then you can actually reconstruct the neutrino energy even if you do not observe the proton. Okay, this is an excellent problem for a course in particle physics. So in Super K, in the 1 kiloton detector, this topology looks basically like a single ring muon with a Cherenkov ring going off at some particular angle. In the fine grain detector, you can see events that agree with this calculation or events that deviate from it. Because if you make a pion instead of a proton, there's a good chance it's going off at some different direction. So you can overconstrain the problem by calculating where you expect the recoil proton to go, and if you see a second track, if it deviates by more than some number of degrees, you don't have quasi-elastic, you do have non-quasi-elastic, and that's an important input. All right. The technical problem with this sort of experiment is that the detectors in the near area are very close to the beam, and they don't see the same profile or spectrum as the Super K detector, which is very far away. Okay, this is basically the difference between seeing a line source, which if you're 100 meters away from a 200 meter decay volume, versus a point source, which is what Super K sees. So this this green curve is the spectrum measured by our near detectors, and then this red curve is predicted for our far detectors, and so then the rest of what are my colleagues spend night and day working on is to make the connection between this spectrum and this spectrum so that we can do a fair neutrino oscillation analysis. And the ratio of these things is given by something we call the far to near ratio, which is in the end a correction factor when we do the oscillation study. All right. Well, this is extremely detailed, and if people really want to know about how we do it, I'll tell you probably offline since my time's getting short. Basically, the two inputs we have are the neutrino, the muon momentum, be it in the 1 kiloton or the Psi-Phi detector, and the muon angle. Okay, these two things feed into neutrino energy in some way, and so we bin it, and this is what is measured. Okay, and then we can put in template spectra and add them up until you get something that fits this. Okay, so if these things add up to make a good fit, you use it. If you add them to make a bad fit, you don't. And that's how you distinguish spectra. And this is just some data showing the power of this recoil proton cut, where the hatched area are the non-quasi-elastic interactions, and the red area, I'm sorry, is the quasi-elastic interactions, and the red area are all the interactions, and there's a sharp spike where it in fact is a proton recoil, and we can select those by making that cut, and here we really enhance the sample, and that's important. All right, so the result of the fit is something like this. So this is the corrected spectrum, this is the measured spectrum data versus Monte Carlo, so since it's a good fit, we think we have a spectrum we can use. And we like to know that the beam is stable, and this just illustrates these profile issues. At the near detector at KAK, that big iron absorber subtends this amount of the beam, so we can definitely see the fall off in the profile, and that helps us know that we're centered. Whereas at Super Kamiokande, to scale, it's this little purple box. Okay, so as long as we can, but also notice that the predicted beam spread is now much wider. So as long as we are within, say, 3 milliradians as our target, we're at a flat part of the beam. So any deficit we see won't be due to mispointing. And we've monitored the profile, and we're within 1 milliradian, so we're doing better than we have to. All right, so as far as event selection goes, it's fairly straightforward. We basically do the same sorts of selections that we would do for atmospheric neutrinos, but then in the end, what we do is we ask that it be within a window around the known beam spill time. And that gives you a spike of events. You can barely see it here, or we've just made 3 simple cuts, a little teeny excess over a random background. But then when you apply the other cuts, especially when you apply the cut requiring the not have any activity in the outer detector, you pick up all the neutrino events and one lucky, but not that lucky, atmospheric neutrino. So we're statistically limited. We only have a handful of events. So we're very concerned that they're occurring with a statistical rate. If you do a KS test on their arrival times, you find that it's quite probable, so we're not concerned about that. Or if you were to fit an exponential to their arrival times, it looks pretty good. So then we get on to doing the fitting. So you've seen all the ingredients. We've tested the spectrum, made measurements in the near detector. They play a big role in getting the shape correct. And then we just have to select the events that we want to use. We can look at, see what the total number of events is, because as long as we have the fraction of new mu charge current in a reasonable shape, we'll see some sort of deficit. And then we can pick out the single ring muon-like events and try to measure the energy spectrum. And we only have 29 of them. Well, so we treat systematic uncertainties. You can see that this near-far ratio, even though we've worked very hard on it, still is the dominant uncertainty. Okay, so there's the data. Take those 29 events and you can plot them versus reconstructed neutrino energy using the two-body kinematics. Or you can just count the fact that we see 56 but predicted 80 and see an overall deficit. So these things are related to each other, right? Not statistically independent, but we know how to handle the statistics of that and combine it into a final, some sort of final result. So here it is. A couple different ways, we've tried a couple different ways of treating the systematic uncertainty. So there's two sets of curves. What we ended up using in our paper was the second method, which just had the more conservative limit at the 99% confidence level. At the deeper in the well, they both agreed very, very accurately. And this is probably too good agreement. I mean, you know, you shouldn't. That the fact that this inner black area, which is the 68% allowed region for K to K, is in such great agreement with super K, is probably just as lucky or unlucky as, you know, the disagreement between Kamiokande and super K. No reason to expect that it would obviously be that good. So, but it is. You have to take the data the way it comes to you, and we strongly prefer a lobe right around a few 2 times 10 to the minus 3, almost 3 times 10 to the minus 3 EV squared. If we were to do toy experiments, we would find that some of the time this lobe would be in a false location. So that's the basis for my argument. So that's pretty much it for this confirmation experiment. In terms of our statistical analysis of all this, basically, we conclude that we reject no oscillation at around 1% probability. We haven't learned anything really new about neutrino mixing or really restricted the parameters anymore, but it's a very valuable orthogonal experiment. And let me just show you for fun a new event. You know, in our current running, we've been running K to K beams since January, and if you've got a good memory for the way super K events look, you can see that there's half the phototubes. So I am now out of time, so I'll just conclude. The evidence is strong for atmospheric neutrino oscillation. However, everything is consistent with the new standard model, pure nu mu nu tau. We don't see nu mu nu e, unfortunately, yet, but there's new experiments that we'll try. And K to K has essentially confirmed this to 1% with a completely different method. Thank you. Yeah.
How long will you run in the K2K? How many years?
As usual, we have a beam budget, but if that runs out, while it's still possible to run the KEK accelerator, because resources have not been shifted to the Japan Hadron facility, we will get extra beam time. At most, it would be 25 or 20% extra, but at some point, too many beam physicists shift to JERI, and then we have to stop.
Is that 2006 or something?
2005. No, not really. Yeah, no.
It was done by the Dari group, and they get something like 2.7 plus minus 0.4 for the delta.
Yeah. You know, one event could, the K to K data is so limited, one event could really push it around a little bit. But it's okay, it's a reasonable thing to do, but we haven't done it.
In the alternate scenario that you, I did not conceive, use wave change neutral currents.
Not explicitly. If it maps into sterile neutrino oscillation, maybe...
No, it doesn't. It's different. The problem is it doesn't have any energy.
Ah, okay.
So we ruled out again.
Yeah, no. Well, we try all variations of powers of E in the oscillation term. So if it's one of those, then we essentially did.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Do you see any new leads in your
K3? Yes. In the near detector, we see we've made a measurement because we had to, and we see about what the Beam Monte Carlos predict. I think it's 1.2% or 1%-ish. And then in super K, it's rather hard to tell because it's mixed in with neutral currents. But there are E-like events, and they're approximately at the rate which our Beam Monte Carlo predicts without any drastic excess. So we haven't yet turned it around to make a limit on it, but it won't be very competitive.
Going back to the issue of specific variable, is there an agreement that the super K calibration specific value is 2.1?
The 2.1 was from this analysis, which is rejecting different hypotheses. Our standard best fit value was 2.5. Yeah, and that's completely agreed upon. Now, that being said, we have the next step in this experiment is to try to do a better and better job with the Monte Carlo. So we've been working hard on neutrino interactions, on incorporating different atmospheric neutrino fluxes, including ones that take into account 3D effects. And each time you put in a different theoretical input, things move around a little bit. So we haven't done that work yet. We have a variety of different results. And probably sometime before this summer, we will settle on our best new estimate for the theory. But you have to pick one. There's really, you know, we do as much as we can to let systematic uncertainties will essentially increase the contours, but somehow you have to pick the central one, and that can affect the best fit. So it can move around, but it should move around within our contours.
Okay, we have to move on. Thank you very much.
Sure.